our country. They are literally letting people make asylum claims, and then they're releasing them into our country. And sometimes, you know, they're being told to report to probation officers years down the road. What is going on right now is chaos.
From your perspective on this lawsuit, specific to Title 42, how that would help this, as you call it, chaos, how we would all of a sudden control this chaos? Because the recidivism on Title 42, you've got migrants that are coming back one, two, three, four, five times that might not have that same ability if they actually were under Title 8.
Because what we know right now is the system is not working. And if you talk to anyone in Border Patrol, the ranchers and farmers in Arizona, people that prosecute gang cases or people at the DEA that are prosecuting, going after the cartels, they will tell you that Title 42 is not the end-all be-all. It's not a permanent policy. It was never meant to be. But it is one of the few tools we have left in our toolbox that is stopping even more people from illegally reentering or illegally entering our country. And look, when President Obama was president, you know, they did, you know, Operation Chokehold. They aggressively sent judges and federal prosecutors to our southern border to aggressively prosecute entry and reentry cases. And even during the Obama administration, they were able to stem the flow of immigration. So I'm not saying that this is some magic wand or solution. But until the Biden administration gets serious about securing our border, until they get serious about going after the cartels, prosecuting people for, you know, illegal reentry, we're going to continue to have this problem.
But your argument right off the top was you were more concerned over the way President Biden tried to lift Title 42 more than actually Title 42 being lifted. So is your justification for the lawsuit, for being part of the lawsuit, that you don't agree with the way President Biden tried to lift Title 42, or that Title 42 should not be lifted?
What I have said consistently is I believe in our institutions as a first-generation American. I believe in the process. And if the president wants to rescind Title 42, he has to go through the lawful process, which includes notice and comments by affected parties. So the first fundamental question is, has the president of the United States followed the legal process? And we say no.
Okay.
You know, just this week, the Biden administration is talking about making sure people from some countries have negative COVID tests. I mean, I think it's the height of absurdity where, you know, there's kids being expelled or not allowed to go to school because they won't wear a mask because of COVID concerns.
Do you still think there's a pandemic going on, or do you think that is over?
What I think is that there are concerns that people have expressed, including the president of the United States, regarding the pandemic and COVID-19. I don't always agree with all of his solutions as a matter of policy, but what I was trying to point out is from a legal perspective is that the president and his administration is taking actions, saying there's a pandemic, and they're literally taking actions to try to mitigate and control it. Then my goodness, one of the things they should absolutely be doing is keeping Title 42 in place.
So let me ask you this then. How do we fix this system? What do we do?
The very first thing you have to do is aggressively enforce existing law. You have to gain control of the southern border. And then once you do that, you can start having a discussion. This is not like rocket scientists in the sense that there are countries like Canada and Australia that have immigration systems that are based on merits and points. But it has to begin with enforcing existing law. And look, I'm out here on the, you know, in Arizona, and it just seems like in Washington, D.C., because we don't have term limits and we don't have balanced budget amendments, there's a permanent political class there, elected political class, too, that has an incentive and a motive in just perpetuating these issues and continuing to divide our country. I guess in a lot of ways I am a subjective optimist but an objective pessimist, because I just think that the last 20 years, 25 years has shown that the people elected in Washington, Republicans, Democrats, a pox on them all, they don't get anything done.
Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Brazilian soccer legend Pelé has died at the age of 82.
What's Pelé now? What a beautiful goal from Pelé. El Rey Pelé. 100 goals for Brazil.
He's often called the greatest of all time and is the only player to lead their country to three World Cup titles. The first when he was just 17 in 1958. He made the number 10 shirt an iconic image in world soccer. Pelé ended his career helping to popularize soccer here in the U.S. when he joined the New York Cosmos in 1975. And later in life, he served as an ambassador for the sport and witnessed its worldwide expansion. Andrew Downey has written two books about Brazilian soccer. He joins us now from Sao Paulo. Andrew, in his own words, I mean, Pelé said that when he started, he just wanted to be as good as his dad, who was also a soccer player in Brazil. He ended up, I think, being a lot more. What made him a legend?
Well, as you said in your intro there, he was the first player to, and the only player to, win the World Cup three times. And I think by that feat alone, that puts him above many of the others that played the game. He was also a guy who took a small town club, Santos, to the top of the world. They became the champions of South America and the champions of the world. He was comparable to, I think, Muhammad Ali in the US. He was the only guy, along with Ali, who was recognizable in the whole world. And I think he did this at a time when football was becoming a business as well as a sport. And that gave him this projection all over the world. And it projected Brazil all over the world, because before Pelé, before that team of the 1960s and 1970s, a lot of people did not know Brazil. And he really put Brazil on the map, and it made him a true legend.
A one-named superstar, that's how you know you're big. What's the mood in Brazil today? What's the country going to do?
There has definitely been a huge outpouring of grief over the last 24 hours, because everyone recognizes, you know, the greatness of Pelé, the legend of Pelé. People were, I think, expecting his death. He's been in and out of hospital for more than a year. And the last month, his family have been posting pictures. And I think preparing people for the worst, because they knew that he was not getting much better. So there is this grief, but people have taken it with a kind of a naturalness, because they knew that it was about to come.
Many big Brazilian superstars that came after Pelé, like Zico, Ronaldo, Ronaldinho, Neymar, they consider him an inspiration, but I don't think any of them really ever eclipsed Pelé in the hearts of Brazilians.
No, I don't think so. Pelé was a curious guy in the sense that he would often refer to himself in the third, and he would say, you know, Pelé is the football player, the public face, and Edson, his name was Edson Arantes de Nascimento, Edson is just the private man. And he had this curious relationship with Brazilians. They realized how great he was, how brilliant he was, and how important he was for the country. But there was a lot of questions about whether he stood up for black Brazilians, you know, enough during the racism that he suffered particularly in the 60s and 70s. There was a lot of questions about whether he should have done more to stand up to the military dictatorship in the 1960s and 70s. And he also had a very private life, shall we say. He was married three times. He had several children. Yeah. Some out of wedlock, and I think these were all issues that really complicated his legacy for some Brazilians.
You know, Andrew, the conversation of who's the greatest of all time, it's such a subjective thing, right? Because it's all about an opinion, but it's a fun argument to have. Argentina's Lionel Messi certainly made his case with what he just accomplished. But when it comes to Pelé, I mean, your opinion, was he the greatest of all time? Was he the GOAT?
My belief is that, you know, Pelé won the World Cup three times. No one else has done that. A lot of people argue today that football is much harder now and that Pelé could not do what he did today. There's a lot of validity to that argument. My response to that, however, is that when Pelé played, he wore boots that were heavier. Even the ball itself was not as round. The pitches were much harder back then. Players could tackle from behind. Players got away with a lot more. Pelé had to put up with all that. They would often play two games in two or three days. They would often be forced to eat apples and chocolate just to keep the strength up, because they never had enough time to actually sit in restaurants and eat meals. So all that, for me, makes football more difficult back in Pelé's day. And if you talk to people who played with Pelé, they all said he was such an athlete, he was such a professional. If he played today, he would play to this higher standard that exists today.
Andrew Downey joins us from Sao Paulo, Brazil. Andrew, thanks for your thoughts.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
19 minutes after 8 o'clock. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Peter Bryant in for Alex Crowe. Coming up, Morning Edition staffers reflect on some of the most memorable stories from 2022. And later this hour, the Milwaukee Dancing Grannies are a staple in many southern Wisconsin parades. They're also the subject of today's Wisconsin Life. That's coming up in 25 minutes.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, inviting you to Wisconsin Public Radio's arts and pop culture show, Beta. We've got you covered, whether you're a fan of comedy.
And Sam Kinison, of course, famously known for being super obnoxious, could not shut me up.
Or literature.
I think Goon Squad calls attention to its complexity a little more because it's structured sort of like a concept album.
Saturday at 9 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Children's Theater of Madison and Becca Cates. Your business or organization can partner in providing the WPR programs that enrich our communities. Join at WPR.org/sponsor.
24/7 Jazz HD2 is available on your smartphone. For jazz, big band, and blues, go to the App Store and download the free WGTD app. HD2 is still available on your desktop at WGTD.org and in the Kenosha Racine area on your HD radio.
The national shortage of veterinarians is being felt here in Wisconsin. It's delaying care for some animals. That story and more Wisconsin news in our newscast at 8:30. Cloudy skies forecast today, temperatures dropping into the mid to upper 30s by the afternoon. And by tomorrow night, a wintry mix or rain possible, highs in the low to mid 30s tomorrow in the north to the low 40s in the south.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from ECMC Foundation, working to improve post-secondary educational outcomes for underserved students through evidence-based innovation. Learn more at ecmcfoundation.org. And from Heather Sturt Haga and Paul G. Haga, supporting African Wildlife Foundation, working to ensure the future of Africa's wildlife and wild lands. Learn more at awf.org. And from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. As the year comes to a close, we asked some of Morning Edition staff to talk about their most memorable stories of 2022.
Hi, I'm Chad Campbell, a producer with Morning Edition. Before every host interview, we do extensive prep work behind the scenes. But sometimes we get a surprise. And those moments can be magical. Like when Rachel talked with singer Ifedayo Gatling of the Harlem Gospel Travelers in September. Thanks to the album's liner notes, we knew there was a special guest on the song I'm Grateful. But we didn't know the guest and Gatling were related.
This special guest is my mom. And
wait, what?
Yeah, that's my mom. I'm
Get
a preacher's
out.
Kid. My mom is Pastor Cynthia McCants. That's my mom.
I think we were all grateful that Pastor Cynthia McCants said yes.
Hello, my name is Destiny Adams. My home state, Oklahoma, is also home to one of the first sit-ins in the civil rights movement. In 1958, Clara Luper led 13 black students to a whites-only lunch counter. One of the students was Luper's daughter, Marilyn.
She would say all the time, I want you to believe in the sun when the sun didn't shine, and to believe in the rain when the rain didn't fall, and to believe in a God that we've never seen. That's the way she would want to be remembered.
64 years later, Marilyn retells her mother's story, hoping to memorialize her contributions to the civil rights movement. With this conversation, I hope to do the same.
My name is Lisa Wiener, producer with Morning Edition. Back in early February, I traveled to Ukraine with our host, A. Martinez, and Morning Edition editor, Rina Advani. We were there to report on the diplomatic wrangling that eventually led up to the Russian invasion of Ukraine on February 24th. But on a Sunday afternoon, 2 weeks before the start of the war, we attended a unity march of foreign expats who now called Kyiv home and who were determined to fight for their adopted homeland.
I don't call myself an expat. That means I'm an ex-U.S. Patriot. I'm a dual pat. I'm a thorough U.S. patriot and a Ukrainian patriot.
Ukraine
might be a distant country, but it is an important ally. And it is really important to show that we, as international and foreigners, support Ukraine.
If there's ever a threat to Kiev, then I will join up with the Territorial Defense Battalion, like I know many of my friends will.
Remembering that scene and the unshakable patriotism of those marchers, holding their nation's flags and chanting in Ukrainian, I think about where they are now. Did some of them join the fight? Maybe they were injured or worse. It was a moment before so much changed. And that's what will stick with me.
My name is Milton Gavada. Look, I love working at NPR, but I'm not going to lie. I think about quitting my job and moving abroad all the time. So I was excited when we got to speak with somebody who did exactly that. Rick Martinez is a food writer. A while back, he bought a car and traveled to all 32 states in Mexico. He was doing research for his cookbook, Mi Cocina.
People inviting me into their homes and showing me how to cook this food, or cooks in a restaurant or in a stall in the market, like inviting me into the kitchen to show me how something was done.
I think about our interview with him a lot because I've been trying to get more in touch with my food culture.
I'm Adam Byrne. A moment I'll never forget was our interview with Kiyomi Lee, a Korean-American who found out in her 50s that her adoption story had been a lie.
Through DNA, I discovered a half-sister who was also adopted, and we have a shared father. And that's when I discovered that he had been alive until about 10 years ago.
Wow.
It begs the question, did that parent even consent to having me be sent overseas and basically vanished from Korea?
You heard Rachel Martin there say, wow, when Kiyomi revealed that she'd been robbed of the chance to meet her father. I had the exact same reaction listening in from the control room. I hope that she gets some answers from Korea's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which is investigating cases like hers.
My name's Julie Deppenbrock, and the most memorable story I worked on this year was about censorship. In their last issue of the year, students at a high school newspaper in Nebraska had published op-eds on LGBTQ rights. Days later, the paper and the journalism program were shut down. Rachel Martin and I spoke with one of the journalists, a trans student named Marcus Pennell.
This had been like the first official thing from the school that was kind of saying, you know, like, we don't really want you here. Like, you can't really be yourself here.
As a journalist, a queer person, and a former teacher, the story hit me really hard. Students are being censored at the same time that schools across the country are banning books that center LGBTQ stories.
Hey, my name is Lily Quiroz. And during a year when reproductive rights were stripped away, this conversation between Leila and Ile was so comforting to me. It was a reminder to take time to ourselves, even when we're feeling frustrated with the world, and that people who have a platform should speak out for people's rights. Ile chooses to do that through her music.
Now the protests are happening, which is empowering, but these things were happening still, you know, this oppression towards women because patriarchy says so.
Is it why you put politics in your music to have these conversations?
Yeah, definitely. For me, it's my way of letting things go for a while and just having more energy to want to keep talking about this in a better way every time, because there is a lot of social ignorance in this world, and it can be cleared out in just a simple conversation. Dime algo bonito, quiero escuchar algo bonito. Dime algo bonito, quiero escuchar algo bonito.
Dime algo bonito, quiero escuchar algo bonito. That's a sampling of the producers and editors who make Morning Edition with their memorable moments of 2022 on our air. They are just some of the dozens of journalists who make this program, along with engineers and technical directors, working every day to bring you stories from throughout the U.S. and the world. Happy New Year from us to you. This is Morning Edition from NPR News.
Brazil rings in the new year with a new president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, sworn in on Sunday, even after serving nearly 2 years in prison. It's a return to glory for a politician who was once internationally celebrated.
The most popular politician on earth.
How Brazil's leftist president won support of the people. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered comes your way from 4 until 6:30 today. It includes news from Wisconsin, too, with Brady Carlson.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
It's 8:30. Stay with us as Morning Edition continues. Up next, the latest news from NPR and then headlines from Wisconsin Public Radio. You can also find more at WPR.org.
From NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. A House committee has made public 6 years' worth of former President Donald Trump's tax returns. The documents were posted a short time ago on the House Ways and Means website, which voted last week to release them. Erie County Public Works Commissioner Bill Geary is playing down the potential for flooding as temperatures warm in western New York following that deadly blizzard that dumped multiple feet of snow.
Hopefully with the warmer weathers, the slower melt, it's manageable. We're not really too concerned with any flooding.
Temperatures in Buffalo are expected to be around 50 degrees today, and rain is in the forecast. Atmospheric rivers have been drenching many parts of the West Coast this week with heavy rain, winds, and snow. Manola Sakaita with CAP Radio reports that weather system is expected to continue into the weekend.
This weather pattern isn't new to the state. Atmospheric rivers are basically streams of concentrated moisture and typically bring lots of rain. They're often helpful when it comes to alleviating drought conditions, but days of heavy rain also mean potential flooding. Chelsea Peters is a meteorologist for the Weather Service in Sacramento.
It's all compounding, and the fact that we're potentially going to see additional storms next week potentially is going to add to that as well.
Local weather service stations have set a flood watch for parts of the Sacramento Valley and the San Joaquin Valley. They advise travelers to look out for impacted roads. For NPR News, I'm Manola Sakaita in Sacramento.
And this is NPR.
With Wisconsin Public Radio News, I'm Peter Bryant. A national shortage of veterinarians is being felt here in Wisconsin, and it's delaying care for some animals. A 2021 study says open vet positions in the U.S. exceeded the number of qualified candidates by over 2,000. That was in 2019, and it's gotten worse since the pandemic. Joelle Carson is director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Medical Association. She says the shortages at clinics go beyond veterinarians.
We're really seeing across the nation and in Wisconsin the shortage of staff workers, licensed technicians that help with vaccines, help with the animals in clinics, as well as your support staff.
Experts also say many vets no longer work 70-plus hour work weeks like they did in the past, and that's also contributing to delays in animal care. If you've ever wondered who's the number one Quick Trip fan in the state of Wisconsin, wonder no more. Evan Casey has more about a woman whose gas station obsession has led to internet fame.
Oh, God, I'm there every day.
That's the voice of Cassandra Berger, or as some might know her as, Quick Trip Girl. She earned that title last year after she visited every Quick Trip in Wisconsin, all 457 of them. Berger has a Quick Trip tattoo. She owns several items of merchandise. She's tried almost every snack they sell. The Onalaska resident started making social media videos about the store. After Quick Trip took notice, they let her appear in a commercial in 2020. Soon after that, they teamed up to make videos highlighting her travels to every store.
I mean, they have said that I'm their number one fan several times. So number one fan.
Berger says she plans to visit newly opened stores across the Midwest in 2023. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Milwaukee Business Journal reports Southwest Airlines canceled another 30 flights Thursday, close to the figures for Tuesday and Wednesday. But Southwest says it plans to return to normal operations with minimal disruptions nationwide today. Cloudy skies forecast today, temperatures falling into the mid to upper 30s by the afternoon. Tomorrow, cloudy, a rain and wintry mix possible by tomorrow night, highs in the 30s and 40s. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. Find more at WPR.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Noom, a personalized weight loss program designed to give people knowledge to set new goals and the tools to stick to them for good. Learn more at Noom, NOOM.com. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working together to create a just world where all people have access to renewable energy, clean air and water, and healthy food. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez. China is grappling with what might be its worst COVID-19 surge since the start of the pandemic. Across the country, hospitals are overwhelmed. Infections have spread so fast since emergency measures were lifted earlier this month that several countries, including India, Japan, Italy, and the U.S., are requiring COVID-19 tests for passengers from China. Global concern that new variants could emerge prompted those moves. Joining us now is Beijing-based Associated Press reporter Dake Kang, who recently visited Chinese hospitals treating COVID patients. Dake, what did you see during your reporting from these hospitals in China?
Yeah, so I had been to hospitals in Beijing at the beginning of this wave, and at first it seemed quite orderly, you know, short lines and all of that. But later, my colleagues and I went to hospitals outside of Beijing in kind of smaller cities and towns. And what we saw there was frankly alarming. You know, we were seeing packed ER wards, patients lined up in the hallways or lying even on the floor because there was just no space for all of the patients that were coming in. We saw ambulances being turned away because medical workers were basically warning that there weren't enough medical resources to take care of incoming patients. So what we saw on the ground was quite dire.
Is there any idea why these hospitals outside of Beijing are suffering more?
Yeah, you know, China's medical infrastructure is quite unequal. In big cities like Beijing or Shanghai, you have, you know, pretty top-tier medical care. But the moment you go outside of the big cities, it's a totally different story. You know, China does not have a strong medical infrastructure in smaller cities and towns, and they do not have enough ICU beds to grapple with China's large population. On top of that, Chinese people in general have a tendency to rely on hospitals in particular for even basic medical care for a variety of reasons, cultural and economic. And so as a result, when you have a public health crisis like this COVID wave, what ends up happening is that a lot of people flood hospitals, and that can easily overwhelm the system.
How did the citizens there react when the government suddenly just lifted the isolation measures earlier this month?
I think there was quite a lot of surprise, confusion, joy. It was a mixed reaction, right? I mean, a lot of people have suffered quite a lot under China's very harsh zero COVID policy, which this year in particular was just getting more and more absurd. I mean, you know, entire cities constantly going under lockdown. It was really difficult to plan any kind of travel because you just didn't know if there would be some kind of snap lockdown or notification telling you that you couldn't leave. So I think a lot of people were happy that those measures were released. But at the same time, you know, there's a bit of whiplash because this change has been a total 180, seemingly overnight. I mean, we went from having harsh measures that the government said would not change, that they would resolutely uphold, to all of a sudden going the opposite direction.
And really quick, China's National Health Commission counted 4,128 new cases the day before that when they released their data was December 24th. I mean, the reality on the ground seems to like really differ from the official data.
Absolutely. You know, the official data stopped being reliable because the government stopped mandating mass testing for everyone. And so they just can't catch all the cases anymore.
That's AP reporter Dae Kang. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
New York Representative-elect George Santos is facing mounting investigations from state and local prosecutors. He's slated to be sworn in next week, but has admitted to misleading the public about much of his life story. His behavior has outraged a lot of people in his district, which includes Long Island and parts of Queens. Here's NPR's Jasmine Gars.
The list of lies Santos told constituents about himself goes on and on. That he got a degree from Baruch College. That he lost several employees in the Pulse nightclub shooting in Florida in 2016. That he's Jewish and his family escaped the Holocaust. That one hit especially hard here among some in Manhasset, Long Island.
I think you used a very serious issue to try and garner votes in an area that has a high Jewish population.
Kelly Sklar votes Democrat. She says she's put off by all the misleading information Santos gave, but
lying about being a relative or distant Holocaust survivor in a time with anti-Semitism raging, that I think is even worse.
He recently addressed the many inconsistencies in his biography on Fox News.
I made a mistake, and I think humans are flawed, and we all make mistakes.
In his campaign, Santos touted himself as a gay Latino Republican. He also said he came from a humble background. He now says he's trying to clear the air before taking his seat in Congress. But those mistakes, as he's described them, might be very serious. There are now several investigations into whether Santos broke any laws.
Don't seat Santos!
Don't seat Santos was the battle cry at a rally in Mineola, part of Santos' soon-to-be congressional district. Local Republican leadership has condemned Santos' behavior, but there's not yet been a call for resignation. Even among local Republican voters, there's a lot of displeasure. Here's Long Island resident Fran Sabatino.
I love that he's Republican and that, you know, his being there will be give the Republicans an edge, but I do not like what he did.
Sabatino says she's disappointed.
I'd be very hard-pressed to vote for him again, and yet I would hate to vote for the Democrats. So,
you're kind of in between a rock
I
and
am.
A hard place.
Exactly, honey, exactly.
For Kelly Sklar, there's no confusion about what needs to happen next.
I think we need to have a revote. He ran on a platform that isn't true. He lied.
Those lies are now under scrutiny by federal, state, and local prosecutors who are investigating whether Santos broke any laws. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
Coming up later today on All Things Considered, Republicans promise more oversight of the Biden administration's targets on climate change as they take over the House in the new year. Some climate activists think the U.S. can still meet some ambitious greenhouse gas reduction goals. To listen, stream NPR on your smartphone or computer, or just listen to us on your reliable radio. This is NPR News.
You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Peter Bryant in for Alex Crow today. The Milwaukee Dancing Grannies are a familiar sight in many southern Wisconsin parades, and they're also the subject of today's Wisconsin Life. That's coming up in just a few minutes. And after that, Morning Edition has a montage of some of the musicians who died in 2022. That's all coming up on Morning Edition.
Wisconsin Public Radio has been a radio pioneer since 1917. That's nearly 100 years of great radio. We're proud of our legacy, and that spirit of innovation continues today. Your year-end support will help carry us into a bright future. Make your year-end gift right now at WPR.org. And thanks.
Support for WPR comes from Lawrence University in Appleton, a national liberal arts college and conservatory, offering an engaging global education with funding for internships, research, study abroad, and more. Lawrence.edu.
WGTD FM is now available on your smart speaker. Simply say, play WGTD on TuneIn and hear WGTD programming. 24/7 Jazz is also available. Simply ask, play WGTD HD2 on TuneIn.
16 minutes before 9 o'clock, here's some of what's happening in the news today. After a tough week for Southwest Airlines travelers, the company says it plans to return to normal operations with minimal disruptions today. The soccer star Pele has died at 82. He'd been battling complications from colon cancer. In state news, a national shortage of veterinarians is being felt here in Wisconsin, delaying care for some animals. And dual-language highway signs are being installed in some communities in Wisconsin. It's part of tribal nations' efforts to preserve their indigenous languages. The Wisconsin Department of Transportation is using federal money to install signs in English and native languages. Cloudy skies in the forecast today. Temperatures falling into the mid to upper 30s by the afternoon. For the weekend, cloudy, a wintry mix possible by tomorrow night, lingering into Sunday.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to solve social and environmental problems to improve lives today and benefit future generations. More information at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's time now for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a resilient group of dancers.
The Milwaukee Dancing Grannies are a staple in southern Wisconsin's parade scene. With their matching outfits and dance routines, they bring joy and inspiration to people, even after an unthinkable tragedy. Christina Leffring brings us their story.
The day of Muskego's Christmas parade has been cold, rainy, and pretty gloomy. Yet Main Street in this small city in Waukesha County is lined with grandparents, parents, and of course kids waiting for the parade. Especially the Milwaukee Dancing Grannies. For almost 40 years, the troupe of grandmothers dancing and waving pom-poms in formation have been a highlight of holiday parades across eastern Wisconsin. But last year, three members and one member's husband were killed when Daryl Brooks drove his vehicle through the Waukesha Christmas Parade. The Grannies have always been a fan favorite, but in light of last year's tragedy, crowds have celebrated their return with standing ovations.
I think everybody on the entire street was standing and clapping. So it was a bit emotional, and it was really wonderful to see.
It actually makes me cry every time I see them, just with everything that happened. And they're so cute, and it just breaks my heart still. And it brings me joy to see them at all the parades.
They're fantastic. We love them every time. I want to be a dancing granny someday.
It's really a lot harder than it looks.
That's Doreen Lopez, who joined just last January.
Well, it's not for the faint of heart. It's a lot of work. It's a big commitment.
Dancing grannies rehearse at least once a week. Each member is expected to perform in at least two-thirds of the parades the group is scheduled for, which in the winter could mean two or three parades in one weekend.
You think, you know, you're going to the practices, it's time-consuming, it's hard, and then you do a parade and you think, worth it.
That's Janet Pauly, another new member. Pauly and Lopez were two of several new grannies who joined in January. After the Waukesha attack, the group decided to hold auditions to strengthen their membership.
I knew that when I started, you realize how time-consuming it is, and I thought, I'll try it a year, and I think we're all in it for the long haul.
A few veteran grannies also danced in Muskego. Janice Kramer has been a granny for 19 years. This past year was particularly hard for her. She knew two of the women killed in Waukesha personally and had a series of deaths in her family shortly after, including her husband. But she's still dancing.
So this kind of helps me get through that. It gives me, you know, I can make it. I can make it. I'm not going to be sitting home in a fetal position somewhere in a corner.
One silver lining is more people have learned about the group. like Kramer's neighbor, who saw her leave the house in the granny's royal blue winter uniform, trimmed with white fur and a fur hat.
He rolled the window down. He said, "Are you really a dancing granny?" I said, "Yes, I am. You know, I don't dress like this for nothing."
She's struggling to keep up physically, but she's still motivated by the camaraderie.
All the girls were so great, just like these new ones are, just fantastic women. I was thinking I might have to retire because I'm getting older and stuff, but these girls are so much fun. I think I have to stick around maybe for a while longer.
Plus, there are the crowds.
Have you ever walked in a parade? Oh my God, you should do that because we're old ladies and you get wolf whistles out there. I mean, I'm 75. How many more years am I going to have somebody doing a wolf whistle to us, you know? That's incentive enough.
The group says they've gotten a lot of messages from people who want to join, and who can blame them. The group will announce plans for expanding and auditions after their members take a well-deserved break to rest and recuperate.
Christina Leffring brought us that story on the Milwaukee Dancing Grannies. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And you can hear Wisconsin Life every Wednesday and Friday during Morning Edition on WPR.
The Gateway Radio Reading Service is for visually impaired listeners who would like to have newspapers and books read to them. In the Kenosha Racine area, easy-to-operate radios are available free of charge. Visit WGTD.org or call 564-3744.
Is brought to you by WPR and NAMI Wisconsin, the state organization of the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
It's 9 minutes before 9 o'clock. Stephanie Elkins joins us on the hour with a preview of Morning Classics. And we have some music specials coming up for you this Sunday, New Year's Day, including the beginning of a new series of broadcast concerts by the Milwaukee Symphony that Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And then on Sunday night at 5, the annual Simply Folk Sing-Along Show. Learn more at wpr.org/holidays.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. Let's spend a little time appreciating the work of some of the musicians who died in 2022. It was a tough year for those who love the sound of Philadelphia. Philly Soul lost a few of its architects, such as producer and songwriter Tom Bell, studio owner Joe Tarsia, and William Hart, singer with the Delphonics. All I know is la la la. In January, we lost a legendary voice, Ronnie Spector, the Ronettes. And in August, one of the greatest songwriters in Motown history died. Lamont Dozier co-wrote smash hits such as Baby Love, Reach Out, I'll Be There, You Keep Me Hanging On, and this one for the Supremes. Two jazz legends died in September. Pianist Ramsey Lewis brought swing to pop songs. And saxophonist Pharoah Sanders took the spirit of John Coltrane into new territories. A Pulitzer Prize-winning composer died in February. George Crumb wrote works as tender as a hymn or as terrifying as war. A number of film score composers died this year, too. Vangelis wrote the music for Blade Runner and went to number one with this piece from the movie Chariots of Fire. Monty Norman came up with one of the most recognizable riffs in film history. And director David Lynch lost two of his collaborators, composer Angelo Badalamenti and singer Julie Cruz, best known for this song from Twin Peaks. She was called the Nightingale of India. Lata Mangeshkar lent her voice to more than 1,000 Bollywood films. Another singer known for film soundtracks, Irene Cara, died last month. Fame was a top 10 hit, and then this song went all the way to number one. What a feeling. He's believing. Two of the men who brought the musical Hair to Broadway died, writer James Rado and producer Michael Butler.
Gimme head with hair, long, beautiful hair, shining, gleaming, steaming, flaxen, waxen.
Speaking of long, beautiful hair, here's someone who brought theatrical flair to the rock scene. Meat Loaf scored one of the biggest hits of the 70s with his album, Bat Out of Hell.
I can see paradise by the dashboard light.
This man practically destroyed pianos when he played.
You shake my nerves and you rattle my brain.
The killer Jerry Lee Lewis was one of rock and roll's founding fathers.
You broke my will, but what a thrill.
Someone who took a slightly different approach to the piano, Romania's Radu Lupu was considered perhaps the greatest concert pianist of his generation. A beloved rock drummer died in March. Taylor Hawkins from Foo Fighters was just 50 years old. In the 70s, a few British bands started incorporating Jamaican music into their sound, and that gave ska its second wave. Terry Hall of the Specials died just a few weeks ago. In the mid-90s, you couldn't go far without hearing one of Coolio's hits. He died in September, not long after his 59th birthday.
As I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I take a look at my life and realize there's nothing left.
And then just about a month later, one of hip-hop's most creative young rappers was killed, Takeoff from the trio Migos. One of the greats in Brazil's Tropicália movement died last month, Gal Costa. And one of the founders of the Nueva Trova scene that thrived at the beginning of the Cuban Revolution also died, Pablo Milanés. This past year, we said goodbye to two of the queens of country music. Loretta Lynn had 16 number one singles on the country charts.
Well, in a cabin on a hill in Butcher Holler.
And the mom in the mother-daughter duo, the Judds, Naomi Judd, died in April.
Love is alive and at our breakfast table every day of the week. Love is alive and it grows every day and night, even in our sleep.
Olivia Newton-John was one of the most popular singers of the late 70s and early 80s. This song stayed at number one for a stunning 10 weeks. We also lost one of the most successful rock songwriters from that time. Christine McVie wrote some of Fleetwood Mac's biggest hits, like Don't Stop, You Make Loving Fun, Say You Love Me, and this one found new life this past year. Also, the man who signed Fleetwood Mac died this past summer. Mo Austin was a wildly successful studio executive who worked with Neil Young, Prince, Madonna, R.E.M., and many others. He was 95. And those are just a few of the many musicians we lost in 2022. If you heard a favorite of yours, maybe just go out and enjoy some of their music over the weekend. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
It's a minute before 9 o'clock. Morning Edition here for you every weekday from 5 until 9. Join us too for the weekend version of the show, Saturdays and Sundays from 7 to 9 on WPR. A preview of Morning Classics is just ahead.
Support for WPR comes from the Northern Sky Theater and Batch Bakehouse. Join the team of organizations that support a wide variety of informative and inspiring programs for the people of Wisconsin. More at WPR.org/sponsor.
Support comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. Whether you need information about Medicare, housing options, home care, or accessible transportation, the ADRC is the place to start. Their services are free. Call 262-605-6646.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine.